as the celebration in the arena continued when the triumph of Hulk Hogan and millions of Hulkamaniacs was in effect raped by the cold-blooded ambush of Sergeant Slaughter right inside the Hulkster's very own dressing room.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 110 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston. And today, well, last week I looked at the show before the first WrestleMania, so I thought I would take a look at a show from right after a WrestleMania. It was just a matter of figuring out which one it was going to be. So I decided to go with 1991, right in my comfort zone, the first wrestling challenge after WrestleMania 7 from March 31st, 1991, because there are some interesting things that happen on this show. And I was watching a bunch of these before I headed down to New Jersey for WrestleMania weekend. I watched the Raw from after WrestleMania 9, which was interesting in that it was clearly taped beforehand, and also a few interesting things on that one, and then also a wrestling challenge from after WrestleMania 8, in which Vince McMahon filled in for Gorilla Monsoon. So the Heenan and Monsoon magic was lost on that one. Here, they are actually joined by a third person in the booth who would remain for much of the year 1991. But before I get into all that, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown, and give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only and all that you can find there, such as the Great Walking in Memphis series, History of Memphis Wrestling, later on in the show. And I did get to 1,000 YouTube subscribers, and thank you to all that answered the call on that. Now, whether I'm going to get ad revenue is still up in the air, but I do think I have 4,000 hours viewed on my channel just based on Larry Bird Night and the Ted Williams thing, although that's only a few minutes. But Larry Bird Night's like an hour and a half. And there's a few other things there as well, including the All in the Family 20th anniversary tape, which I don't get to monetize. That belongs to CBS. But apparently, that is how Joe Morata of the Our Vantage Point podcast found my YouTube channel way back when, was he happened to be watching that and saw my name as the uploader, and he was very surprised. And I don't know why I have that tape. I think it was because I watched a lot of All in the Family around the turn of the century, so like the year 2000. It might have been the last VHS tape that I got before I got a DVD player at some time. I think it was my senior year in college, with the first DVD being Caddyshack and the second one being Billy Madison, so watched those movies a ton. I have a podcast out that dropped a little less than 2 days ago, recapping WrestleMania weekend from my perspective, where a good chunk of it is recorded from the road, and then the last part is in my kitchen due to some unforeseen technical difficulties where the recorder shuts off if you're approaching your exit and the GPS lady speaks up. Apparently, I now have learned a way to mute her, so I can record more from my car if I see fit. But that's always kind of an emergency option for me. It's not the ideal podcast studio, the mobile Hyundai Sonata studios. I'm just going to pretend that everything has sponsorship from now on. No dick pills, though. That's not really my speed or anything. But do go back and check that out, although I may fill in a few pieces here and there with things that I didn't mention from WrestleMania weekend, particularly at WrestleMania itself. I spent a lot of time talking about my quest to get coffee and how cold I was, and then the two guys sitting to my left. But I did not mention the girl who was sitting to my right. And I couldn't really hearken a guess as to her age, because she actually could have passed for anywhere from 16 to 30. And during the Brian Kofi match, she was so incredibly into it, as she was for a lot of the matches, and was doing a running commentary that annoyed me for about 7 seconds at first. And then I took a step back and said, wait a minute, Winston, you can't complain about somebody who's really earnestly enjoying this show and is just so into it, and then also complain about the people who are just, you know, so into themselves and so stuck up about the whole thing. So just kind of keeping that in mind, I was like, I'm glad I'm sitting next to this person who was just going crazy during the match. And when Kofi finally won, you know, she leapt to her feet like the way that they would probably want their fans to react, WWE, to something that would happen like that. And I remember, you know, sitting at, you know, Chaotic Wrestling shows as well and seeing people who are really into the show. And I'm not talking like the ultra snarky dudes who can be funny and all. And I said my share of stuff during the show. In fact, I tweeted a lot of it out. I mean, come on. When Kevin Nash shows up in a doctor's outfit, the Dr. Oz joke is just sitting right there. So how could I not make that? I know it's just easy and all, but I was cold, and I really needed that joke to sort of warm me up. But I had a great time over the weekend, and I know next year in Tampa, I said on the podcast that it's highly unlikely that I'll be able to go to that. However, in a couple of years, maybe I will be able to go to the alleged Los Angeles WrestleMania that is going to be happening in 2021. That one is probably going to take place in late March, just kind of. Here's the secret of figuring out your WrestleMania dates. Just take a look at when Easter is and know that they aren't going to have it on that day. And I know that they often try to avoid the weekend before. So if it's on the first Sunday of April, they do move it back to late March, because I don't know what the latest WrestleMania it has been, but I know it's been no later than like April 8th, 9th, or 10th, or anything like that. It's never gone into mid-April. I know that the 7th might actually be the latest one they've ever had. In fact, that the show the other night went all the way into April 8th, so that may have actually been the latest WrestleMania of all time, with the final pin, I think, taking place at 12:25. Didn't get back to my car, I don't think, until 1:05. But I go over all that in the podcast and the experience at the tailgate at Ring of Honor G1 Supercard the night before, and meeting many, many, many people for the very first time. Just about 100% of them were delightful, too, which is quite refreshing. Because I had also mentioned how I went to this U2 fan convention thing out in Las Vegas years ago, and I remember at that, 85% of the people were just complete weirdos, and I was like, I can't deal with this. Now you're saying, now come on, how can you say that when you have people showing up, dressing up as wrestlers and wearing actual championship belts? Well, I'm sorry, I just give it a pass. You know why? Because I enjoy it, and hey, I'm in there with them. I just don't have a belt that actually fits around my waist. I have the damn toy belt that was the big gold belt from 2013, which if I hadn't taken out of the box, it would probably be really worth something by now. So anyway, on to Wrestling Challenge from March 31st, 1991, the 6-year anniversary of the first WrestleMania, which is not mentioned during the show, but that's okay. WrestleMania 7 itself, I kind of was making comparisons between that in my head to WrestleMania 35 with all the babyface victories in big matches. Now, there you had the Big Boss Man not winning the Intercontinental title, but you did have the world title change hands. You had the tag titles change hands, albeit to the Nasty Boys. But it was a feel-good show with a lot of good guys going over. Except WrestleMania 35 actually was scheduled for a stadium and stayed there, unlike WrestleMania 7, which was famously touted to be in the Los Angeles Coliseum. And then they realized that they were not even going to come close to filling that place, so they moved it and blamed it on security concerns with the Gulf War and Sergeant Slaughter. But honestly, the Los Angeles Coliseum, by all accounts, is a complete dump. So I don't know why you would want to hold a WrestleMania there. I mean, that's why when WrestleMania 37 rolls around, they're going to have it at that new stadium in Inglewood. So it'll be kind of neat to see all that. It'll be exactly 30 years after they wanted to have the big WrestleMania in Los Angeles. Now, as for this wrestling challenge taping, it took place a couple of weeks before WrestleMania 7, so actually 12 days on March 12, 91 in Biloxi, Mississippi. They got 9,000 on hand, which is a pretty nice gate, in my opinion. Not exactly the home territory for the World Wrestling Federation at that time. But a lot of notable things happened in just kind of some of them on the dark matches that didn't air at all, such as Ricky Steamboat in his second match back. He had wrestled the night before on the Superstars taping, but he prevailed in a dark match over Bob Holly. Yes, the very same Hardcore Holly. And it's just odd thinking that he and Ricky Steamboat wrestled each other in 1991. It feels like that those are two guys who definitely did not cross at any point in time. I don't know if Bob Holly was still there during Steamboat's brief 2009 comeback, but you got Steamboat's there 85 to 88, and then 91, and then Bob Holly shows up a few years later as the race car driver. Second interesting thing on this taping was matches filmed for Coliseum Video's WrestleFest 91. I guess they had come a long way from WrestleFest 88, which was held at County Stadium in Milwaukee, which I think was held there partially out of spite to keep the NWA crowd, because they were going to do a show either the next night or the night after in Milwaukee as well and burn out the crowd. Matches for WrestleFest 91 included Greg the Hammer Valentine versus Rick Martel in the total like reverse of what roles you would think of them as. Yeah, I know a lot of people think of Rick Martel as the model. God, my accent really came out on that. But you think of Greg Valentine as this uber heel all through the 80s and Rick Martel as this super baby face all through the 80s. And now in 1991, the roles are completely reversed. But a much more interesting match is the Legion of Doom taking on the Hart Foundation. Now, I don't think WrestleFest 91 is actually on the award-winning WWE Network, but I may want to double-check that, because I kind of want to see that, as the Harts were not carrying the tag team belts, which I don't know if they didn't care about telegraphing what was going to happen at WrestleMania for the crowd in attendance, because there are other people on this very episode of Challenge who showed up without their championship belts, or maybe it was just hidden from TV view. I mean, there are ways that you could do it. There were some WrestleMania warm-up matches on this show that were also dark matches. Hulk Hogan versus Sergeant Slaughter, you don't really think of, well, you're going to have the match before WrestleMania, because they didn't have a Hogan Slaughter. They were setting up the program, but you kind of think of WrestleMania 7 as their first meeting in that spot. But they kind of did this, I think, as the warm-up match. And what was definitely a warm-up match, Jake Roberts taking on Rick Martel, who apparently did double duty in a blindfold match, preparing for that WrestleMania 7 match that is very divisive, I should say. And finally, the main event at this taping was the former WWF champion, the Ultimate Warrior, defeating Earthquake in a steel cage match. You don't think of Warrior and Earthquake ever facing each other, but this was by necessity, as it was supposed to be the Ultimate Warrior versus the Macho Man Randy Savage, but Savage was hurt the entire time leading up to WrestleMania 7. I believe it was a hand or arm injury, and they just needed to keep him on the sidelines for as long as possible to make sure he was good for the WrestleMania match, and then also for the Japan trip shortly after that. But on this show, we're going to see a couple of guys who dueled at WrestleMania 7 and effectively wrapped up whatever issue they had, the Big Boss Man and Mr. Perfect, still the Intercontinental Champion. We're also going to see the Legion of Doom, who prevailed rather quickly over Power and Glory, under a minute. And the Warlord, who had a match with Davey Boy Smith that I can never remember if it's better than this Tuesday in Texas match that they had. Those two dudes were definitely married to each other. But a number of other interesting items that are on this episode of Wrestling Challenge, such as an appearance from Andre the Giant in 1991 during the... Well, it's kind of an odd comeback for him because he never actually wrestles on TV. You don't see him after WrestleMania 6 in any sort of wrestling capacity, although he did have one match, which I will get into a little bit later. And a couple of debuts or repackagings of people, such as Jim the Anvil Neidhart joining the broadcast booth alongside Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby the Brain Heenan. Colonel Mustafa, who actually debuted the day before on Superstars, and thus the taping the day before this, rolled out as the third man of the Triangle of Terror. I'm laughing because the whole Colonel Mustafa thing is just so hilarious to me in retrospect. But less hilarious, but still very good, is Sensational Sherry. No longer a queen, but, you know, she's still doing all right because she's with the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, now. And I always wonder how it's going to be for these people in Biloxi watching this a couple of weeks before WrestleMania. They're like, why is Sherry joining up with Ted? And then Ted's on, I don't know if they you know, explain what the tapings are and all that. And also, we're going to get more reviews and recaps of WrestleMania 7. Stars and Stripes Forever, people. And certain results that happened during that show. So without any further ado, why don't I just get into it. This is episode number 110. So I'll be taking a look at sporting moments from the year 2010. And I swear to God, I actually have sports stuff that... from sports that I have not actually covered before. And hey, why don't I play one of them right now?
Now Torres. Iniesta's in the middle. Torres is trying to find him. It's broken for Fabregas. Now it's Iniesta. This is it. That's the goal. Spain have surely won the World Cup.
This may come as something of a surprise, since I don't even know if I've mentioned soccer one time on this show, but I enjoyed the hell out of the 2010 World Cup. For whatever reason, probably it being having it on at work literally all the time because of it being in South Africa and the time zones worked out in that it was on the TV that was right next to my desk and everybody would sort of gather around it. The VP who was in charge of my group at that time was from Ireland. I believe Ireland was in that World Cup, so he was certainly invested in it, along with the rest of us. I guess some people were in it for the U.S., making, I think, the quarterfinals in that one, although, as I recall, they got a little lucky. But I remember the final match between the Netherlands and Spain, because I watched it in Canada while at my bachelor party on the Sunday, waiting for our flight back to Boston that night. And most people remember that World Cup for all the vuvuzelas, or I think that's what they were called, the ones that were making noise. All I know is that I watched more of the 2010 World Cup than any soccer event before or since, just because of the circumstances. But I also enjoyed the quality of play, the mix of countries that were in it. I mean, hell, the United States didn't even qualify for the 2018 World Cup. I'm sure Fox was really happy that they purchased the rights for an event that the U.S. didn't even bother. I remember when the U.S. boycotted the Moscow Olympics, NBC didn't even bother to televise it in the form that they usually would. They just kind of did highlight packages every so often. So anyway, as we get into the show, we start with Bobby Heenan and Gorilla Monsoon. And they talk about the big things that happen at WrestleMania. And then Gorilla brings up the number 3, as in the three-man booth, to give Jim the Anvil Neidhart something to do as we start Bret Hart singles push number 5 or number 3, depending on your counting method. At the very least, the Anvil, he might not exactly be Jesse Ventura in the broadcast booth, but he's not boring. So he at least can put a few words together, even if it sounds a little awkward. He brings a certain zaniness and craziness to the entire thing. And by the way, Think of Jim the Anvil Neidhart if he was still alive, and you would have to assume that the Hart Foundation would have been inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame anyway. I think they may have just done it this year as a posthumous thing because Natty is still an active wrestler on the roster. Imagine if Jim Neidhart is standing there and some dude in a Rastafarian hat, Whitey Marley or whatever the hell his name is, decides to tackle Brett in front of Anvil. The things that a prime Neidhart would have done to that dude. Holy crap. I just laugh thinking about it.
Three is a magic number, Brain. You know that?
Yeah, I know that.
We're going to have three right here on Wrestling Challenge. A new broadcaster here on Wrestling Challenge. I'm going to introduce him right now. Jim the Anvil Neidhart.
Hello, Gorilla.
Hello, Jim.
It's nice to be here. And all I know is, if the weasel can do this, I can too, baby.
The Brain chimes in about Mr. Perfect retaining his Intercontinental title at WrestleMania. But I love these shows, and they're going to throw it to Gene Okerlund to recap WrestleMania 7. And the reason why I love these shows is it's like the cheapest possible way for me to actually discuss pay-per-views without reviewing the entire show itself. Although I once wrote like a 7,500-word think piece on WrestleMania 7 addressing the build and doing an FAQ about the show at the beginning of it. I should probably just post it or do some sort of series at Pro Wrestling Only. I mean, I know it, as I said, wouldn't be as good as the Walking in Memphis history series, but it would be something unique and very, very long. Maybe I don't, you know, I read those Up Rocks things sometimes, and I don't know how many words they are, but there are a lot of graphics, so that's why I kind of enjoy those when I do look at them. Gorilla had referred to WrestleMania 7 during the show as the largest audience in pay-per-view history, which is extremely dubious given that you kind of don't get those metrics right away. I think that they may have been cheating by including the Armed Forces Network, which they were airing WrestleMania on that year, and making a big deal of it because patriotism and all that stuff. First thing that Okerlund covers is the Randy Savage Ultimate Warrior career match, but then he kind of swerves away from that oddly, and I'll get to why it's strange in a second, addressing the Nasty Boys defeating the Hart Foundation for the Tag Team Championship. Anvil took the pin in that one, getting hit with the megaphone. So I don't know if that was used as an excuse to put him out of action for a while. I mean, anything is plausible, I guess. So this kicks off the Nasty Boys reign of the summer of 91, where it felt like they were on TV every freaking week. So I mentioned they started out with Savage Warrior and went to that. Well, now they go to Elizabeth in the crowd with her bizarre sweater that she had on with the stars that was a very 1991 looking outfit. So they go back to the Savage Warrior match. I couldn't stop laughing as this is a very serious moment, some of the best storytelling that the WWF ever did. And we all know that because, you know, a lot of people tend to agree with that. But the notion of Elizabeth scalping tickets outside the LA Sports Arena is somehow funny to me. Like she's so scared and frightened, like a little kitten all the time. But she's going to put that aside. She's going to scalp tickets to that WrestleMania, although I'm not sure if that one actually sold out. They may have sold the building out because they probably sold about 15,000 tickets for the Coliseum that fit 100,000. So you could just shift it to the sports arena and you've got a sellout right then and there. And the way the match ends with Savage losing the way that he did after the five elbows to Warrior not putting him away, the little bit of back and forth, Warrior talking to his hands like a moron, and then knocking Savage out of the ring three times, pinning him with a foot, and the way the camera cuts to Sherry as Savage loses really kind of sets the whole thing up where, oh yeah, it's the end of her career, theoretically, too, because even though she's a manager, she's not like Jimmy Hart, she's not like Heenan, she's not like Slick, she doesn't have multiple clients, she's completely tied up in Randy Savage, unless you were at this taping in Biloxi and you knew that she was now with Ted DiBiase. And also, if you get the kayfabe hat on and you somehow also follow their Japan tour with SWS. Kind of awkwardly, Savage wrestles in Japan and has Sherry with him. So kind of put all that aside for a second. The reunion story, they show the redheaded woman who is crying her eyes out in the front row. The original fan that they would show at these events, because I think she was at WrestleMania 8 also. Like, she was the 1991 version of that guy who gets all bug-eyed when Undertaker loses at WrestleMania 30. So the next match they get into is the Ted DiBiase Virgil grudge match. I think the $1 million belt may have been on the line, but they weren't making a big deal out of it because that's saving that for the SummerSlam match. Kind of the thing that took away a little bit from Virgil here is you got Roddy Piper on crutches at ringside. Kind of, I don't want to say he was inserting himself into it too much because I think it was necessary in order to get Virgil over to the level that he eventually got. A lot of that is owed to Piper basically selling out to get Virgil to be really popular. And then all of a sudden, when Piper is not with Virgil, did you ever notice that nobody cared about Virgil anymore? In fact, the Raw after WrestleMania 9, I'm watching it. It's taped at the Manhattan Center a week or two before WrestleMania. Virgil wrestling Bam Bam Bigelow and the crowd just completely crapping on Virgil with Virgil sucks chants. It's incredible. So Sherry is the new manager for Ted DiBiase, which makes sense because Ted must be a serial monogamist when it comes to managers or whatever. You know, it's only one at a time, and, you know, him by himself between the Rumble and WrestleMania. A little bit strange, given you always had Virgil there. You could always count on him to run interference. Now you got Sherry, who is completely fearless. She will throw herself in front of a Mack truck to win a match. And then when Sherry, you know, she's there for about a year. It's almost like a transition thing, Sherry with DiBiase. Like, DiBiase got her for, like, her walk year in free agency before she left for Shawn Michaels. It's kind of like when Reggie Jackson got traded to the Orioles in 76, except much less disastrous than the way that turned out. And then finally, the Hulk Hogan winning of the World Heavyweight title for the third time, the unprecedented third time. Always funny in modern times to listen back and to hear, oh, unprecedented three-time champion, never been done before. And they don't show the footage of the actual match. They show his entrance and the celebration afterwards. And they say that the tape from Coliseum Home Video will be out on April 11th. So an 18-day turnaround for the Coliseum tapes. And what was up with Alex Trebek pronouncing Hogan's name that way? Hulk Hogan! I want to say that Bob Uecker did it at WrestleMania 4 after pronouncing it the normal way at WrestleMania 3. Like, what the hell's going on with that? Is that, I don't think it's a Canada thing, but why would you pronounce Hogan's name so weirdly? Hulkster comes out with the American flag, but it's not, it's definitely not Rougeau-sized, and it's not normal-sized either. It's basically like the size of a flag that you would see flying outside a car dealership or something like that. Like, one of these things that's like 70 feet by like 50 feet that like is so enormous where you're like, holy crap, that's a really big flag. But I guess there must be studies have shown that people are more willing to go into a car dealership with a giant American flag. I don't know. There has to be a reason for it. So as we go to the celebration after Hogan wins the match, which he's got blood all over his face, which tells you that this is a completely different era. There was also, at the WrestleMania 7 party at my house, a kid who bled from a bloody nose because people from my youth hockey team were over to see WrestleMania that year, and somebody took a DDT on the floor and didn't know how to take the proper, you know, didn't know how to take the bump properly. I mean, you'd think an 11-year-old would know how to take a DDT from watching enough WWF wrestling. But no. He had to screw up, got a bloody nose. I didn't get in trouble, I don't think, but we had to institute a no-blood policy after that.
And put it all to rest. The war is now officially over.
If he was still alive, I'm pretty sure that John Lennon would be glad to hear that war is over per the account of Gorilla Monsoon. And I guess we're never going back to Iraq ever again, according to him as well. Regis Philbin, you should remember, is also on commentary for the main event of WrestleMania 7. And I thought he did a good job. I don't think he was as fun as, say, Elvira was at the main event of WrestleMania 2. But that just might be my own personal preferences and love for Elvira's boobs and stuff like that. And also when she was freaking out over the blood of Bundy, which, by the way, was mild compared to Hogan's blade job at 7. Elvira, why aren't they stopping this? And Jesse Ventura, just like a dad, like, it can't be stopped. The match can't be stopped. So great. Donald Trump is shown marking out for Hogan at ringside, being very presidential as always. And Heenan, of course, unhappy that Hogan won, but he's still got to chime in.
I'm still going to have my party Tuesday night on prime time. I'm still going to Vegas, and I'm still going to have a bunch of guests. Who cares?
It would be nice if they would post the 1991 episodes of Primetime Wrestling on the network. Hell, I'll even settle for the last few months of 1989, since they just randomly stopped. I think it was in the middle of July. Well, the two nights after WrestleMania, they had a Tuesday episode, and it was from Las Vegas, so they had an angle where Heenan was throwing a party. I think Vince dances during it, and it was a lot of good stuff. This is during the studio era, but they kind of went away from that because of WrestleMania being in Los Angeles.
Standing at ringside, Donald Trump cheering on Hulk Hogan.
Well, I'll hold my tongue on that, but I will say, aren't you looking forward to the presidential administration of guy who wears the Mets jersey to all the WWE pay-per-views? I haven't actually watched 35 yet to see if he's front row opposite hard camera, as he always tends to be, because, you know, WrestleMania gets to be pretty expensive. I don't know what kind of dough he has. Now, hey, back to the business at hand. I have praised Sergeant Slaughter greatly on this show for his work as a heel back in 1981 with the Cobra Clutch Challenge, and also in Mid-Atlantic Wrestling later that year, in 81. And even this Iraq angle, from the perspective of, is the angle distasteful? Yeah, it probably is, but there are very few people in the history of professional wrestling who could have thrown themselves into this character and made it work as well as Sergeant Slaughter did. So he loses the match to Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania. So you figure, well, why would you even bother doing rematches, because you already beat him? Well, Sergeant Slaughter knows a thing or two from being around the territory system in the 80s. So he's a guy who literally knows how to get his heat back, and that's by throwing a friggin' fireball. So it's my understanding that that song came from a poem that was written after the Watts riots called Burn, Baby, Burn. But apparently it was inspired by The Towering Inferno, that movie from 1974. So I don't know. It really doesn't matter. Sergeant Slaughter putting on a clinic in how to get your heat back, literally and figuratively. The normal nice acting job by Hulk Hogan with more Oh My Gods as he's lying there than a Pornhub film. I mean, it was really something special. But hey, Suburban Commando coming to theaters later this year.
Close. Yep, yep, yes! Ah! Fire! Hard! Hard!
I had mentioned previously that I belonged to a curling club in 2014 and 2015. Coming out of the Olympics in Sochi, I kind of joined it for a discount at the end of that one season, and then played the entire following season as well on Sundays only. And it was a 60-mile drive out there. I actually missed the beginning of WrestleMania 30, and the beginning of the abortion that was WrestleMania 31 as well. But curling is such a great sport, and it was the 2010 Olympics because of how into it the crowd in Vancouver was. And how can you not love a sport where you can drink beer while you're playing in it and it really doesn't kind of impact your skill level? And two, a sport where attractive women are yelling, harder, 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 and all that other stuff. So, hey, you know, there's a lot to like there. Sergeant Slaughter is in the ring. No belt, by the way, because they did that awkward cut that you'll often see around, you know, just after a guy has lost the belt where he'll all of a sudden he'll just be in the ring. There'll be no entrance, but he's got a pal, and as Slaughter was sometimes tended to do during this period, he runs a little bit long.
I told you a short time ago that I declared war on the WWF. I told you that you needed a new leader, and I, Sergeant Slaughter, along with my commanding officer, General Anton, have become your new leader.
Why don't you put on your running shoes and get to the fucking point?
Yeah, I agree. Let's get to the part where Slaughter actually introduces Colonel Mustafa and the hilarious reaction of the people there.
Mustafa, what kind of name is that?
Last Saturday night, I'm walking into Madison Square Garden with my friend Dave, and we were talking about Mustafa Ali and his recent name change. Like, oh, Vince doesn't like to have first names on guys. He wants to shorten it to one name. And we couldn't really figure out a good reason why you would do that, considering, you know, Ali, you already have Muhammad Ali out there. Don't take the name of somebody who had come before who is much more famous. Like when I said, like when LaDainian Tomlinson decided to go by LT when Lawrence Taylor had only been in the sport a decade before. Well, now we finally have our answer to the Mustafa Ali question. And it is that Vince McMahon was visited by the ghost of Gorilla Monsoon, who came down from heaven and appeared at his bedside one night and said, Mustafa, what kind of name is that? I don't know why the ghost of Monsoon sounds like Jerry Seinfeld, but it is what it is.
I am appalled and disgusted about what transpired at WrestleMania 7. Wait a minute. That's the Iron Sheik.
Yeah, this is the former World Wrestling Federation heavyweight champion, the Sheik.
That Colonel Mustafa, that's what Slaughter wants, that's what he gets.
I am grateful that they did not totally insult my intelligence there by not acknowledging the Iron Sheik, who is extremely recognizable. That's Tony Atlas. Hold the phone. That's Tony Atlas. Like Roddy Piper a little bit before this with Saba Simba. So a rare example of the World Wrestling Federation acknowledging a guy's past. I guess there's a very brief window for that sort of thing. Now, when I saw Colonel Mustafa, I don't remember actually seeing this episode where they acknowledge him as the Iron Sheik, but I knew who he was, obviously, from the tapes. And the thing that always bothered me, and I said this before on the podcast, but it warrants mentioning again, the whole Iran-Iraq thing bothered the hell out of me. As somebody who was 12 years old and actually knew about international relations and how Iran and Iraq had a bloody war that lasted 8 years that basically ended in a stalemate, like, how could the Iron Sheik just turn his back after saying Iran number one for the entire decade of the 80s and now all of a sudden side with Iraq? Now you can say, oh, well, clearly the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I don't know, okay? But, hey, you know, a reason why the Iraq War was a mistake, and I'm talking about the 03 one, is by toppling the existing order there forever, how horrible it was, it emboldened Iran. Because if you'll remember that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad all of a sudden became pretty brazen towards the United States in the 3 or 4 years after that. So I'd love to be in the room, and who knows, maybe Pritchard talked about it on his podcast. I don't feel like finding the episode for that. Signing the Iron Sheik in 1991, the year of our Lord, 1991. You get together and you say, well, we need to find a Middle Eastern guy, and he's the first one who comes to mind. But I'm also thinking, did they like see his WCW NWA run where he literally... literally turned up pregnant at that 1990 Great American Bash or whatever it was. At the end of the day, it goes back to Vince McMahon's loyalty to certain guys who do him a solid at some point in time. For the Iron Sheik, it was taking the title off Bob Backlund and then dropping it to Hulk Hogan in a 5-minute match the following month and kicking off Vince's Let's Make a Shitload of Money campaign, the national expansion. So he has a loyalty to him. But this now leads Monsoon and Heenan into a... I love this sort of stuff. They kind of discuss the meaning of patriotism.
If any, I suppose that you're going to stand up for these guys and say that, yes, that was perfectly all right what they did.
Hey, it's none of my business with Slaughter.
What do you mean it's none of your business? Are you an American?
Well, yes, I'm an American.
Well, then stand up for something.
You mean I'm going to have to take up for every worthwhile or unworthwhile cause?
Ambo, do you see what I have to put up with here?
I can't believe it. Why don't you get yourself a little green shovel and dig yourself a foxhole for yourself?
And bury you.
You know, I have to admit, I'm kind of with Heenan on that. You got to prioritize and pick your battles, as it is with really anything in life, because you just can't be running around trying to do everything and police everything. By the way, Colonel Mustafa is facing off against Dale Wolf here. It's kind of weird with the whole introduction and all that. So Mustafa actually does kind of look decent. He doesn't look as pregnant, so congratulations to him. He must have had the kid. He was 9 pounds, 2 ounces, as I recall. Gut-wrench suplex. Backdrop driver as well. If there was one thing the Iron Sheik was always very good at, it was laying guys out with those suplexes and letting the world know that he's ready to work All Japan at a moment's notice, even though he's very unlikely to be asked in 1991, and he picks up the win with the camel clutch. Rather interesting, because apparently that must be a group finishing hold, because Slaughter had started using that, because he can't use the Cobra clutch anymore, because DiBiase has dibs on it. I love the notion of dibs with finishers. They have that in the locker room. And Slaughter beats up Dale Wolf a little bit after the match as he's thrown to the outside. Not much to it. I mean, they would do the three-man beatdown, you know, frequently leading up to SummerSlam when, honest to God, you want to make fun of the AWA for having Sheik Adnan LKC main eventing super shows against Vern Gagne, but the World Wrestling Federation had a pay-per-view in Madison Square Garden and had the Iron Sheik and General Adnan, Sheik Adnan LKC, main eventing it as two out of the five wrestlers in the match, which is just one of the most insane things ever.
It seems Sergeant Slaughter has enlisted another merciless mercenary to join him in his fight against Hulk Hogan.
Merciless mercenary? I see that Sean Mooney spent a lot of time on that one. At least it's not as stupid as Ed Olczyk saying tremendously tremendous at the end of the 2011 Cup Final. But, oh my God. Or like that time I saw the Tim Robbins Band years ago where he had some protest song about John Ashcroft and he, guess what he rhymed Ashcroft with? Ashcroft! At the very least, we have a much more preferable lyricist in the Event Center along with his tag team Power and Glory. The Doctor of Style Slick, who by 1991, it was certainly trending downhill. It certainly didn't appear like he was cycling out anytime soon at this point in time, but by the end of the calendar year, he's completely gone. But hey, you know, listening to him here, it shows that he still had it.
You know, I knew when I saw Glory Paul Roma, and I knew when I saw Power Hercules in single matches, I said to myself, there comes a congregation of sophistication. All you gotta do is put it together and let the band roll on.
Yeah.
And ever since that day that these two gentlemen have formed together as the most formidable tag team competition in the World Wrestling Federation, Federation today. Ooh. They have excelled. Yeah. They've Ooh. Climbed to the top of the ladder. Yeah. And everybody's afraid of power and glory. Yeah. Well, you have good sense in being afraid, because when you step in the squared circle with power and glory, it just might be your last appearance.
There isn't a whole lot of credibility to what Slick is saying, given that Power and Glory lost in under a minute to the Legion of Doom at WrestleMania 7, but all right, may have been done beforehand. So I want to look on the bright side that Slick, still a very smart guy. Here is a man who looked at 1990 solo Hercules and said, you know what, I can make something out of him again. Because it's funny, because Slick actually managed Hercules briefly in the fall of 1986 before selling him to Bobby Heenan, which Hercules somehow had no problem with. But when he sold to Ted DiBiase, all of a sudden he has a problem. I think it's because Herc knew that DiBiase didn't have a manager's license and that the whole thing was probably null and void. So we have a second interview here, and it's on to a guy who was completely excluded off the WrestleMania 7 card. I'm forever fascinated by these guys who don't end up on the WrestleMania show. Yeah, I think we can figure out why Dean Ambrose wasn't on WrestleMania 35, but, you know, go back in time to see, you know, maybe not so much guys whose matches were cut for time, but I'm talking guys who were just left off the card completely. The mystery of Paul Orndorff at WrestleMania 3. I guess Kamala had his match cut at the same show as well, and also at WrestleMania 9. But here is Tugboat, and let's see if he can stay on his feet.
You know, these days in the WWF, the competition is getting tremendous. They got big, giant men like the Warlord. I mean, look at the man. His arms are like tree trunks, those huge legs supporting that awesome body. You know, he grabs his opponents, shakes them, grabs them, throws them down, smashes them, crushes them. That's before he puts them out of their misery. Boom! You know, and then you got crazed maniacs like Fuji's mean find, the Berserker. The man's a wild man, a lunatic. He gets in that ring, and you don't know what to expect. Well, let me tell you, on the high seas of the WWF, there's one big boat, the Tugboat, and he's going to take care of them all, no matter how big or how small.
You know, it's really the damnedest thing, because when I came out of the Port Authority on 41st Street on Saturday night, I come out, and there's a panhandler, and he gets up, and he made the exact same speech the Tugboat just made, word for freaking word. Hand to God.
Left point, Wyman with five, scales it towards the net. It's blocked down by Giroux. He'll clear it. And the Flyers with a comeback for the history books from 0-3 down to win the series in seven games.
In doing this series, I've had a lot of fun at the expense of the Montreal Canadiens, the Los Angeles Lakers, other teams that I dislike. So now it's time for me, Mr. Boston Bruins fan, to take some of his own medicine, blowing not only a 3-0 series lead against the Philadelphia Flyers in the 2010 Eastern Conference semifinal, but also blowing a 3-0 lead in Game 7 of the series. Certainly less than ideal from my perspective, but like a racehorse in the Kentucky Derby who runs into a lot of traffic, gets a bad trip from the jockey, we kind of did have an excuse losing David Krejci in the middle of Game 3 and Adam McQuaid. So those two guys were there for the three games that the Bruins won, were not there for the four games the Bruins lost. Conversely, the Philadelphia Flyers got Simone Gagné, a notorious Bruin killer, and Jeff Carter back from injury for Game 4 of the series, and the Flyers won all the games that they played it. Concussion-addled Mark Savard despite his overtime winner in Game 1, and the fact that the Bruins were playing Trent friggin' Whitfield late in that series. But I had bigger problems at the time, because I remember going to Game 7, and I had a tooth that was eventually going to need to be root canaled, and I was just dying standing there because I had no painkiller that was strong enough to actually dull the pain of that. Eventually, you know, antibiotics took care of it for a while, and then it got root canaled Labor Day weekend. So just know that, yeah, while it was a painful moment for me, it was actually literally painful for me at the time as well, and it all got paid off the next year. I do remember filling my car with gas driving home from the game And it was one of those gas pumps that was playing music instead of having the little TV. And it was playing Elton John's, "Oh, I guess that's why they call it the Blues." I'm like, "Oh, we're not the Blues, we're the Bruins," but still the same damn concept. Up now, we have the Big Boss Man taking on Jim Corbett, for whom there is no cage match length. There's a little thing for him on the IWB, the wrestling database, or whatever the hell it's called, and his only two matches are from this one taping in Biloxi. But as Boss Man is coming in, I am delighted that Bobby Heenan does the old Rodney Dangerfield bit from Caddyshack.
Yeah, he's a good-looking guy, flat top, goatee, good-looking man, just like you, Admiral. You're right, Gorilla.
What a stupid-looking haircut. I mean, not on you, I mean on him. On you, it looks good, Angel. Him, it doesn't look good.
Why, you want to start trouble here?
No, I didn't come. I'd write to my opinion on the journal.
Oh, it looks good on you, though.
The issues between Heenan and the Big Boss Man is pretty much wound down with the Mr. Perfect match at WrestleMania, and Boss Man is on to other things, namely against the other law enforcement officer in the World Wrestling Federation, my hero, the Mountie, who is going to do the little inset promo, but that's just not enough for a character like Jacques Rougeau, because he's going to sing.
Boss Man, this is your land. This is my land. From California to the New York Islands. From the Redwood Forest to that stinky, slimy place of yours, Cobb County, Georgia. This land is made for the Mounties.
But Mountie, longtime listeners to Greg's Mountain, know that there is a Canadian version of this song already, with just different places. Here we go. This land is your land, this land is my land, from Buena Vista to Vancouver Island, from the Arctic Circle to the Gulf, the Great Lake Water, whatever. Sorry, I'm used to the American version. I did sing the Canadian version at my dad's college reunion in 1988 up at Acadia University in Nova Scotia. So anyway, back to the Big Boss Man, who is so incredibly slim at this time, and he is moving around the ring. Actually, saw some shades of the Big Boss Man in, I hate to say this, Baron Corbin with his run around the ring spot, or run around the ring post thing, where he slides out of the ring and then runs around and goes back in really quickly. The difference is that the Boss Man wasn't dressed like a freaking waiter. Like, I kept yelling for a cappuccino because I was still trying to get coffee when that match was going on at WrestleMania. But, yeah, it was not to be, I guess, for a cappuccino. But the Boss Man had become so skinny by early 1991. He needed some new size clothes. And it was a real problem because in this match here, his shirt came completely unbuttoned in a two-minute match. Like, he needed, like, better-fitting stuff. The only thing holding it together was the little seatbelt strap that went diagonally across his across his chest. So he hits the leg drop on the man, kind of laying on the ropes throat first, which I don't know if there's a real good name for that. So I'm going to call that the 404, because Rey Mysterio has the 619, and the Big Boss Man should have the 404, because that was the area code for Cobb County, Georgia, back then. They added another one, I guess, in 1992 for the suburbs of Atlanta. Actually, they added two of them. Heenan calls the Boss Man a bully, and I can't disagree with that. Heenan is spitting some hot truths in this one. He has a point. I mean, he's dropping, you know, that ball with the chain onto Heenan's chest all around the horn in late 90, handcuffing guys to the middle ropes, and he hits the Boss Man slam and puts away Jim Corbett 1-2-3. And my whole point is made where, yeah, the Boss Man's been a babyface for over a year now, but he never really, I guess he's a little bit of a softer touch, but he just kind of cuffs Jim Corbett to the middle rope and leaves him there. And all I could think is, wouldn't it be hilarious if he just left the guy there and then they didn't unhook him? And then we get to the whatever the next match is, which I guess is Mr. Perfect versus Reno Riggins. It would be funny if Jim Corbett was still there, like they didn't have a key to actually get him out. But I guess for safety reasons, you got to get him out of there. But we get some, you know, a little snippet of what you're going to get with Jim the Anvil Neidhart on commentary.
Yeah, Bossman whips him in. Well, big hard dive. Knock down anyway, baby. Yeah, stop it, big Bossman. Big uppercut, baby.
I appreciate the Anvil's intensity that he's bringing to his color job, but it just strikes me that if you're out in a group, Anvil is the kind of guy at the bar who keeps wanting to buy Jaeger shots for everybody when everyone else knows that it's just going to knock them the hell out for the rest of the evening. But that's the kind of guy Jim the Anvil Neidhart is. He's not going to sugarcoat it. He just is who he is. If you disagree with me on the Anvil, you can take it to ProWrestlingOnly.com, where you can explore other podcasts such as Strong Style Story, which did a pod blast, a under 20-minute quick review of the G1 Supercard. This last week, we saw the dramatic return of the Pro Wrestling Super Show. I can't remember when the last one we had of those, but you can explore other podcasts other than this lovely pod, along with match reviews, features, and retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows, movies, and more. Join the conversation by signing up at the PWO forums, online for over a decade with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of a hell of a lot of threads. The message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to discuss a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the microscope form, or discuss more general topics in wrestling's past and present. Check all that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com. And of course, I'd be remiss if I did not mention the WorldCast podcast. There, I said it once, I'll say it again. They're in the middle of World Class 1983, people. So if you're not listening to that, you are definitely missing out. So they go to the event center, and they actually are kind of sort of plugging an event. Sean Mooney is the UK Rampage Tour of the spring of 1991. But Mooney informs us that we're sold out. So I love what a cock tease that is. Poor 4-year-old Richard Land, or however old he would have been at that point, can't go to the UK Rampage Tour because Sean Mooney told him so. Wednesday, April 24th, though, they will be airing a card on Sky Movies, which I assume would be like an HBO-type thing, a subscription pay channel. But when it comes to going to Europe, and especially the United Kingdom, it's all about Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldog, who's going to be taking on Rick Martel as a sort of half of Strikeforce meets half of the British Bulldog's dream match.
Winston's excited, and the British Bulldog's excited, because Rick Martel, the model Rick Martel, let me tell you something, Winston, he doesn't like pretty boys. So when we step in the ring, Martel, there's not going to be no arrogant spray being sprayed in this British Bulldog's eyes, because Winston takes care of me in the ring. And if you want to see a model and you want to see beauty, you take a look at Winston.
So wait a minute, Davey, you're telling me that your dog doesn't like pretty boys, so are you thereby insinuating that you yourself are ugly? I mean, I don't think Davey Boy Smith is a particularly ugly guy. I mean, he may have done some ugly things, if you believe Diana Hart Smith, and I'm not sure you really can, because when you get your book pulled from shelves because there's so much questionable stuff in there, I'm not sure how much credibility you might have at that point. By the way, Matilda, much better looking dog than Winston. That's just one man's opinion. I don't know. Opinions vary, as Dalton said in Roadhouse. But we get a second promo. We get Jake the Snake Roberts facing Earthquake on the UK tour. Now, they haven't had their little thing happen yet that took place during the course of April, where Earthquake kind of got scared away by Jake on Superstars, where they did that old school thing like they did with Sergeant Slaughter and the Iron Sheik back in 84, where one guy is coming back to the locker room from his match, and then the other guy is walking to the ring. Feels like a really bad job of being a traffic cop at Gorilla, but let's see what Quake has to say about Jake, you know, before he starts killing house pets.
Oh, Jake the Snake Roberts, baby, anytime, any place, anywhere, Daddy. You want the Earthquake? Well, baby, you don't have to look very far, baby, because you've got him, right, baby?
Roberts, if you're looking for trouble, you definitely came to the right place. If you want the Earthquake, you got him, because I walk away or run away from no man. Roberts, go come into the ring and feel the earthquake. You'll go out on a stretcher to the hospital and you'll be finished in the WWF.
What I think would be a great drinking game is to take Jimmy Hart saying baby, but you can't drink every time he says it, because I actually went back and counted. He said baby 4 times in 6.16 seconds. So that is an incredible baby rate.
But are you using my babies now?
No, I don't think I'd use your babies, because I don't think I could keep up, quite frankly. So our next match, which is non-Jimmy Hart related, is Mr. Perfect, the Intercontinental Champion, with Bobby Heenan. So he's out of the broadcast booth for this one, taking on the great Reno Riggins, who I profiled back in episode 19. And here, the Heenan-Perfect combination, they would always do that towel toss and always make it good. So if you're keeping score of that, Perfect gets up on the second turnbuckle in the corner and just, you know, blind pass over his head, and Heenan catches it in the center of the ring. And it goes without saying, the Mr. Perfect gum thing, which I absolutely adore and would do all the time in college with my big red gum. In fact, I did it at the tailgate at WrestleMania, and nobody really kind of noticed or probably even saw me do it, because I would be on my way to my secret bathroom in lot 27, and I would take my, you know, bottle can of Miller Lite that I would have, and I would toss it up a little bit and then bat it with my other hand into the dumpster. A nice little homage to Perfect. So his program is now with the British Bulldog, Davey Boy Smith, even though it's not mentioned in the promo earlier. But it's a nice little bit of preparation getting him ready for Bret Hart at SummerSlam down the road. So we're kicking off some SummerSlam programs now, like Mountie and Boss Man. But with Mr. Perfect and Bret Hart, we've got to build up Bret a little bit and get him ready for that level. Monsoon suggests that Winston is going to get a piece of Heenan at some point, to which I would counter, no, probably not, because Heenan still has that suit from WrestleMania 4 where Jesse Ventura said he looked like a Chinaman, which sounds racist, but he was referring to Hop Singh, the cook from Bonanza, who actually did dress in an outfit that looked very similar to that. Now, I don't know if they were planning something for Reno Riggins, but he elbows Perfect in the head to get out of a waist lock to start out. And I rather like Reno Riggins. He's definitely shot up the list of my favorite enhancement talents in the course of doing the show over the last couple of years. He reverses an Irish whip into the corner, but Perfect gets feet up. But Riggins doesn't run into it too hard. He rolls backwards and then hits Perfect with a clothesline. And I got to say, Reno Riggins, more over than 50% of the roster right now in WWE. I'm not ripping the modern time product or anything like that. Single leg takedown by Mr. Perfect to reassume control of this match after the nice little Reno Riggins spots. And again, the duo of Mr. Perfect and Bobby Heenan was so overdue to be given to us. You have to wonder why Perfect couldn't have been a member of the Heenan family right from the beginning. You had that ridiculous angle with the Red Rooster and Heenan, which maybe had a few entertaining moments, like when Heenan was mic'd at ringside and the whole angle from primetime with the Brawler and Rooster. I thought that was kind of funny. But the fact that we lost out on these little interview moments and how literally Bobby Heenan knew Mr. Perfect Curt Hennig when he was a child because of Larry the Axe Hennig being in the business as well. And luckily for us, we don't get a Davey Boy Smith inset promo talking about his upcoming matches with Mr. Perfect. Instead, we're going to get the comedy duo of Hennig and Heenan.
You know what we hate more than dogs? It's dumb people that own dogs. So Davey Boy, this man is number one. That must make you number two. You know what number two is.
Come on, take him off. Take him off.
Why don't you ever be serious? What a piece of garbage.
Oh, I love Gorilla so much. He's such a ball buster, a piece of garbage. I wonder if he's more mad at Heenan for just not liking dogs, or if he didn't like Heenan working scat there with the poop humor. And Perfect is a little bit too loud with his spot call, because he's doing the, now you're going to see it, the Perfect Plex. Yeah, I know. It's, you know, him taunting the crowd or whatever, but it's such a beautiful move when he does it. That's why he was always my preferred guy on WrestleFest. You put guys away in a Royal Rumble using that. The cradle suplex that Harley Race would do was much lazier, where you just kind of lay on the mat and kind of roll a shoulder over. The bridge by Mr. Perfect in doing it, it just made that move. And it really is a shame that he got hurt. And he picks up the 1-2-3 to win over Reno Riggins, who had a little bit of shine earlier on, but the Intercontinental Champion prevails.
Matt Garza trying to make Ray's history and baseball history. The 1-1. Santiago, it's a fly ball to right. He's going to get it. Zobrist makes the catch, and this game is over. Matt Garza has faced 27 hitters and has thrown a no-hitter.
I think I only remember Matt Garza's no-hitter in July of 2010 for the Tampa Bay Rays against the Detroit Tigers for one reason. It was the first night of my honeymoon in Wyoming, and the bar we happened to be in had that game on. Like, huh. Well, a no-hitter. So now maybe I'll actually remember that his name is Matt Garza and not Hector Garza, because the guy has, he pitched his entire career with me calling him Hector Garza, because all I could think of was the wrestler first. He beat him to the punch. He had the first name. And then when I think of Hector Garza, all I can ever think of is he was once sidelined in WCW with a torn scrotum. And then I'm just filled with pain. So speaking of stuff that probably, no, well, little remembered stuff, we have Gene Okerlund on the platform. That's what this is leading to. And he calls Mr. Perfect and Heenan up. And yes, the interview segment was still on the platform for Wrestling Challenge. We don't see the barbershop debut until the next set of tapings. So right after WrestleMania 7, it starts on the April 14th edition of Challenge. So Gene gets Heenan up there, who tells Mr. Perfect to take a powder. You just wrestle the match. You don't have to do the interview. And they're now once again pushing that angle of dissension in the Heenan family. It seemed like something they would always come back to once a year. Back in 89, you had it with the Brainbusters leaving towards the end of the year. They were pushing that. You have Andre at WrestleMania 6, and maybe a couple of other things in 1990 that I'm not thinking of. So here in 91, we're pushing that again. And I think it was the most natural to do it with Heenan's guys rather than Slick or Jimmy Hart, because he didn't have a stable. He would always correct Monster, like, no, a stable is for horses. I am a family. And that's why you gotta love, that's why I would want Heenan as my family. I want to be part of a family rather than, you know, a stable of guys. Unless, of course, it's a stud stable, in which case I'd have some pretty hard-ass dudes backing me up, and I'm not talking about Robert Fuller's penis. But this is the period of time where Andre the Giant had returned for a brief period, but not doing any appearances in the ring on television. And for whatever reason, and I think it has to be, because he was gone for so long in 1990, and I can't remember if he actually turned up on Herb Abrams' television or just threatened to, but that would be why he is now all of a sudden back on WWF TV. So we're going to reestablish that he is split from the Heenan family. For those of us who missed WrestleMania 6 and didn't get it on a pay-per-view basis or have rented the tapes or whatever, let's reestablish Andre against Bobby Heenan. So that's the split we're talking about here. So Okerlund starts needling Heenan about all the stuff that had been going on, such as Heenan getting thrown into a thing of grapes by Andre on Primetime Wrestling as Vince McMahon watched on in delight while delighting all of us by wearing all those Zubas pants and gear.
The Bobby Heenan family has never been tighter. We've never been more united. We've never been happier.
Well, that's not the impression that I've been getting as of late.
Like what?
Well, recently, on the World Wrestling Federation's primetime television, I happen to think that Andre the Giant was expressing some negative feelings toward...
No, no way!
What about the great?
Well, you gotta understand something. Andre the Giant is the biggest member of the family. We're like that. What happened with the great... the back, great for the skin.
surprised Oakland wasn't like, well, why did you keep your white sweatshirt on when you were in the crepes if it's so therapeutic? It doesn't really get to the skin if you're wearing long sleeves. So I'm all for that sort of stuff. I mean, hell, I love aloe vera. It saved me from a little bit of a sunburn from WrestleMania Sunday, so I've been applying it the last several days. Also, big fan of apricot scrub, you know, that you apply to your face. It gets rid of blackheads and stuff like that. All you really need to do is buy, like, the $2 or $3 thing at Target, and it works very well. Now, I would buy the one that says refreshing on it instead of the other one that has the weird oil. I don't know. That's a tip I picked up somewhere else. So Andre the Giant comes walking out. I don't think Andre uses any facial scrub, because this is the unfortunate period where he just stopped giving a shit about his sideburns, and it's like all puffy and stuff. So he just kind of motions for Heenan to come down, because when you're his size and you can barely move, you're not going to be climbing stairs, especially when there's no railing to grab onto. And he actually did have one match on that European tour in a six-man with the Rockers of all teams, teaming against Mr. Fuji in the Orient Express. Now, what I'm going to do right before I play this is get down on my knees and pray to all the major deities that I do not have to break out the Andre to English dictionary.
I'll show you. Put it there. There you go. Andre turned him on the juice.
Every time I want to translate Andre, I want to turn into that WCW translator when Berlin came in. He says, well, he's basically like, I laugh at people that I don't like. I've had enough of you, Heenan. I don't like you anymore. And he makes it pretty clear. But the great part about this storyline is that, yeah, we get Heenan out of the way first, but we get some somewhat delightful comedy segments with Heenan, with Andre going forward, where the other heel managers refuse to believe that he is actually now a babyface. Now, yeah, come with me and, be part of my group. And this led to the great Sensational Sherry thing that I'm not convinced was actually a bit. Because the whole setup, which was at the end of April, was that Andre is sitting at a bar with Arnold Skolin having drinks, and Sherry comes in, starts hitting on Andre to get him to go with her, which would have made sense because DiBiase's already with her, and they have a connection with the Mega Bucks and all that going back several years. So you think she'd have a good chance. Instead, Andre just kind of grabs her and leads her over the bar and spanks her in a very comic fashion. I'm not convinced that that was actually filmed for an official World Wrestling Federation vignette. I feel like that might have been hidden camera footage, but you never tell. I probably should blow up my thoughts on that because it's 91 WWF. I'm probably going to do that episode at some point anyway. And Andre, if you recall last week, said, you know, you're not going to make me retire, Big John Studd. You're not going to make me retire that way. And I mean, let's face it. Nobody was going to make Andre retire. The guy was practically dying and wrestling over in Japan as late as December 1992, and he dies late the following month. So he's actually true to his word. These managers in this storyline keep coming forward to try and bring him in as their enforcer, and this leads to Jimmy Hart saying that, yeah, I have brought in Andre to be Earthquake's tag team partner, which now kind of sets up Earthquake to move to the tag division. Earthquake attacks Andre when Andre manhandles Jimmy Hart, and then eventually we get the turn of the tugboat, which I covered back in episode 43 with through the tears in my eyes as Tugboat turned on the Bushwhackers and took what could have been Andre the Giant's spot alongside the Earthquake.
LeBron, what's your decision?
And this fall, man, this is very tough. And this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach and join the Miami Heat.
Miami Heat.
I know LeBron James was making that whole decision thing about, you know, donating to charity. I think it was for like the Boys and Girls Club of America. But what a PR disaster that was to like stiff the Cleveland Cavaliers, although he eventually went back and made good on it. But, you know, the whole line, taking my talents to South Beach, I mean, it just sounds like a sexual euphemism of some kind. Just kind of an odd way of putting it. I don't know. So up next, we have the Warlord taking on John Allen. And, oh, the other day at the tailgate, I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Scott Criscoll. He says, so what's the next episode you're going to do? I said, you know what? I think I'm going to do a 1991 episode of Challenge where I'm going to explore the question, the Warlord, was he any good? And the answer, well, I'll get to that in a second, because Gorilla is still basking in pleasure over Heenan getting his hand grabbed by Andre the Giant. See, that I probably should have mentioned that during the segment. They shake hands, and Andre, with like his giant freak hands, just squeezes his Heenan to the ground and then steps on his hand at the end. Which, that's also a pretty funny visual, especially since Heenan is going to sell this for the rest of the show. So back to the question, was the Warlord actually good? And the answer, probably not. After a lot of thought, I've had a lot of time to think about this. He's a tag team wrestler who certainly has some deficiencies, but you can't hide them when he's out there by himself. Now, was he held back, maybe? I don't know. He shows some agility at times, like when he does like a flying shoulder block. You know, he looks okay. Other times, he looks kind of goofy. And speaking of goofy, the Warlord story in Bret Hart's book is so great when he's sleeping in the lobby of a hotel just so that he doesn't miss the wake-up call to get on the bus for, you know, some European tour or whatever. I'm like, wow, the Warlord's just like me back in 2003 when I was afraid to sleep on Sunday nights because I was always afraid I would oversleep and miss the manager's meeting at Barnes & Noble. So what would I do? I would stay up all night playing High Heat Baseball 2004, for which I played way too much of. But anyway, and I would sit there and I would just drink coffee and smoke cigarettes the entire night, usually iced coffee, until I had a little bit of an incident, and this is actually going to go into my... this is how I started drinking hot coffee, because it took me a while to get used to really hot coffee. I would always, you know, make the ice cubes for it ahead of time and have iced coffee instead. But unfortunately, one time I had put a bottle of Diet Cherry 7-Up in the freezer, and it exploded on me as I was making ice. So effectively, I had Diet Cherry 7-Up ice cubes, and I can't use that in my coffee, so I just decided to drink it hot one day in 2003, and that's how I ended up drinking coffee, and that leads directly into my WrestleMania story of me trying to get a coffee, because I haven't been able to shake that 16 years later. I guess the lesson there is, kids, don't put 2-liter bottles of soda in a freezer and then forget about it, because bad things are going to happen. After the shoulder block, the Warlord devalues Colonel Mustafa's gut-wrench suplex from earlier by throwing out one of his own. So I'm now a little bit less impressed by Colonel Mustafa because now the Warlord has done the exact same thing. So, like, don't let guys do that exact same move twice on the same show. So Heenan, as I said, he's still selling his hand on commentary as the full Nelson finishes off John Allen for the Warlord. No swing to the Warlord's full Nelson, probably because, like I said, he's a little clumsy and kind of a goofy guy. It's very odd to think of a 6'5", 330-pound muscle guy as being goofy, but I think that's what the Warlord is, and that's why he, you know, participated in that mascot prank at that Miami Marlins game a couple of years ago where he clotheslined Miami Marlin or Merlin the Marlin or whatever the hell his name is, and then Booker T ended up coming to the rescue. So, I don't know. My official decision, Warlord, not good, but, you know, he's okay. You know, as part of the greater cornucopia of wrestling, I can accept him.
Kicked off. Look out. Gets past Manning, and it's Tracy.
That great New Orleans Saints Super Bowl moment is dedicated to Steve Bennett of the Sportscasters, my occasional podcast partner, still on the mend from a recent surgery. I believe a new Sportscasters will be coming out where he'll detail his story. And yes, he is forever my New Orleans Saints ambassador. As I've said, I'd like to have ambassadors for, you know, fans of various teams out there, just to kind of so you could stay plugged in on things. And like I like having a Kansas City Royals ambassador, so I kind of know what's going on there, because you can't, there's not enough time in the day to follow that sort of thing. So he'll keep me plugged in on the New Orleans Saints and the Buffalo Sabres. Plus, playing stuff for Peyton Manning losses in the playoffs where his team was a definite favorite, it never goes out of style for me. Although I will say this about Peyton Manning, he actually was a very good host of Saturday Night Live. I do have to tip my cap to him there. So up next, we have the Legion of Doom taking on Mike Casey and Bob Bradley, who definitely was a guy, Bradley, who would not go away, because he was in WWF in 1982, for God's sakes. Hearing him on the Our Vantage Point podcast, them mentioning him from a show of October 82. Gorilla says that it's just a matter of time before the Legion of Doom gets their hands on the Nasty Boys and the tag team titles as well. And I'm laughing, kind of thinking of how low I ranked Legion of Doom in my Place to Be Nation greatest WWE tag team ever project last year. I had them at number 56, which I think owes to the fact that I saw them as kind of a disappointment, because they were definitely post-peak. And in looking at my list, it's even more amusing talking about how Power and Glory lost to LOD in under a minute at WrestleMania 7, because I have Power and Glory at number 52, so somehow ahead of them. I don't know. Like I said, they're kind of past their peak. They're very much, they remind me of Albert Pujols with the Angels. Yeah, he's been mostly okay in that role, but things just aren't what they were like when he was with the Cardinals. The same thing for LOD. It's not the same as when they were in the AWA, when they were in the NWA, when they had the real shoulder pads, and it wasn't like the bright red thing that they had. Basically, for merch purposes, I think Vince or whoever the merch person at WWF was like, yeah, if they're red, we're going to be able to sell more than if they're totally black and they don't look as imposing. And that kind of hurts them. Now, Anvil says that the LOD guys are actually pretty smart wrestlers. And I thought, well, he should know, because he did wrestle them on this very taping.
The Legion of Doom, these guys, they don't come any tougher, any stronger, any faster, any smarter.
Now, let me ask you a question, Anvil. You really think they're smart? I mean, to walk around with two haircuts like that, you think they're smart?
They don't have antlers, do they?
No, they don't have antlers. They have lousy haircuts. They need antlers.
Case closed.
No, what they actually need is a Howdy Doody puppet from a landfill. No, actually. I'm thinking, LOD, are they actually smart? I'm pretty sure I could take Animal in a game of Scrabble. And I'm not just saying that because I know he does those simplistic promos. I really think I could beat him in Scrabble, Chutes and Ladders, probably in a game of Sorry. I don't know if I want to play Monopoly. That'll probably take too long. So Gorilla points out that the Legion of Doom is very dangerous right now because they are the team chasing the titles. So that gives you that little extra oomph when you're hungry for the championship. But the Nasty Boys have a little inset promo, and get your drinks ready because Jimmy Hart's there. So let's see how many babies we get.
Legion of Dummies, eat your heart out, baby. Bring you World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, the Nasty Boys.
My, 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 the tides have changed. We told you we'd take them, and we took them. Legion of Doom, we got what you want. Enough to get him.
I think Jimmy Hart might be limited to 8 babies per show because he's only used one there, so he might be rationing them at this point in the program. Hawk now with a gut-wrench suplex of his own, further devaluing the Colonel Mustafa one from earlier. So basically now I hate Colonel Mustafa's performance because it's basically just like everyone else. And who the hell is agenting this friggin' taping? Yeah, good job, Strongbow, with this one. Just let everybody do the exact same friggin' move. Animal is whipped by Hawk in that cross-corner double-team move into Casey, Mike Casey. I had originally written it down as Allen. Well, a lot of these guys are pretty faceless in this one. They follow it up with the Doomsday Device, because you know Bob Bradley wasn't going to take that move, and that gets the 3 count. But because this is Wrestling Challenge from 1991, that means we have to get Bobby Heenan kind of reacting to something related to Mike McGurk.
Let's go up to the lovely Mike McGurk.
If there's one thing that I'm never going to get tired of, it's the Bobby Heenan, Mike McGurk stuff of early 1991, where Gorilla is totally busting Heenan's balls, like, she'd be a welcome addition to some of the barracudas you have out there. Again, I sound like Jerry Seinfeld, but in any event, I will never get sick of that. I love the long montage that's been on YouTube, like, speaking of dogs, but, like, let's throw it to the lovely Mike McGurk. Bow wow. But, on the flip side, stuff that I definitely will get tired of. Up next, we have a vignette for the upcoming debut of IRS Irwin R. Scheister. And I'm sorry. They're like, I'm looking at this. Vince McMahon totally got audited by the IRS in 1990, and that is why this character exists. There's no other explanation for a tax man, but you know, it's the beginning of the occupational gimmicks of the 90s, isn't it?
With April 15th just a few weeks away, I'd like to take a moment to offer a little advice as a certified tax expert on exactly what constitutes deductible charitable contributions. First of all, to be deductible, charitable contributions must be accompanied by signed receipts. Now, I know your heart might be in the right place, but unless your receipts are in the right place too, like here on my desk, then deductions for charitable donations are not allowable. Besides, who are you trying to kid? You don't give to charity out of the goodness of your heart. You do it out of greed. And the only person you're really trying to help by giving is you. You make the donations, you take the deductions, and you pay less tax. Well, I say that's cheating, which, in case you've forgotten, is not allowable either. Oh, I love this.
All right, I'll say it again. The whole concept of this character is not that he's a bad guy because he's a tax agent. He's a bad guy because he's a rogue tax agent who will not let you take legally allowed deductions. It's what he seems to be saying here is that, no, you're not allowed to itemize your charitable contributions, although he would fit right in under the current tax system. By the way, you don't need signed receipts on the desk anymore. It's all electronic now. So there are different ways you could do that. Also, there's less itemization now because of the tax bill. See, when I file, not that I'm going to be releasing my tax returns. I mean, that's not a requirement of podcasters, at least as far as I know. But if you're married filing jointly, you're probably going to end up with the $24,000 standard deduction, or $12,000 for single people, and you're going to be less likely to itemize anyway, plus you're going to run into the new ceiling for state and local taxes, or SALT, which is capped at $10,000, which is a much bigger deal in states with higher property values. So you're talking New York, you're talking Connecticut, New Jersey, California, which is why this tax bill was basically designed to hurt people in the states who did not vote for the president, which kind of makes me scratch my head. I mean, I guess he figures, well, I'm not going to get votes from them anyway, so why should I write a tax bill that would benefit those states in any sort of way? So, I don't know. I don't mean to make this political or anything, but if you're going to throw a tax man on TV, it's going to get me thinking about it and how Vince McMahon has never released his tax returns that I know of. I would love to see that. Although, actually, with Linda McMahon, who was part of the cabinet and I guess, you know, left recently, or I don't know if it's cabinet designation for the Small Business Administration. Anyway, it's splitting hairs. But is there a way to turn IRS into a babyface? I don't know. Maybe you make him like an Andy Dufresne character. That's probably what happened to Vince in 90. He never should have let Dufresne do his taxes.
Oh, taking it as Bergeron nicely able to step away.
Hey, I played a bad one earlier. I have to play a good one now because I did go to the 2010 Winter Classic at Fenway Park. Not that I could actually see what was going on because I was in the center field bleachers and I spent the first 57 minutes of that game complaining about, number one, not being able to see anything below the player's waist, and number two, being almost completely surrounded by Flyers fans. Very angry that this alleged home game, I'm just completely surrounded. And then, if 9 years later, I'm at a Winter Classic where Blackhawks fans are surrounded by Bruins fans. So I got a nice little payback on that one. Bruins win it 2-1 in overtime, and then we blow it in the playoffs to the Flyers. Ugh. So anyway, up next, we have Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man, in a very fitting bit of, you have the IRS vignette, and then it cuts immediately to Ted DiBiase walking down the aisle. He is taking on Pat Armstrong, who is no relation to Bob, Brad, Steve, or Scott. But the one thing he's got going for him is he has an incredible mullet. Even by like late 80s standards, that is some good stuff. The sound on the video actually goes silent for a good minute there, and I'm in a panic. I'm like, am I going to lose everything? Like, am I not going to be able to hear what Ted DiBiase has to say? Ted is out in the black and gold suit here. And I once again, I have to point out, on placetobenation.com, there's an article from 3 or 4 years ago written by the legendary Parv from the Pro Wrestling Only feed with a insanely detailed analysis of all the jackets that Ted DiBiase wore over the years. It is thoughtful. It is hilarious. It may descend into parody at some point, but then it comes back around to just being hilarious again. It's so great. For anybody who's a fan of this era, I'm going to have to link to it again. When DiBiase hits the ring, and it's very unusual because he's walking that aisle alone. There's no Virgil after the Royal Rumble, and you get Sherry joining him at WrestleMania, this being taped a couple of weeks before the event in Los Angeles. But Ted grabs the house mic and, DiBiase, you look like you have something to say. Do you?
Everybody knows that the Million Dollar Man never settles for second best. I buy only the finest, and I pay top dollar for what I get. And I got an announcement to make here tonight. I want to introduce you people to the new manager of the Million Dollar Man. Might call her the Million Dollar Manager. I give you the sensational Sherry.
She's going to be picking up some extra money here, Ambrose.
Wow!
Look at that outfit.
Is she a knockout?
Better than some of the barracudas I've seen you with lately.
Talking to Neidhart?
No, talking to you.
Excuse me.
Always hilarious when the brain would ogle Sherry on her way to the ring, just as he does there. But once again, Gorilla breaks out the word barracuda, which I know Gorilla is down with the lingo on the streets. So I consulted my Urban Dictionary to find out what does he mean when he says barracuda. And the top definition is for barracuda: a promiscuous, sexually aggressive woman, someone who takes a traditionally masculine approach to getting laid, less interested in a committed relationship, more interested in having the sex and walking away in pursuit of the next score. Consequently, such a woman quickly gains a reputation for her sometimes devastating effects on the men she sleeps with. So that is what Gorilla Monsoon says that Bobby Heenan has been hanging out with. Oh my God. Yeah, total ball buster he is. So picture yourself in the crowd at this taping in Biloxi a couple of weeks before WrestleMania 7. How do you make sense of Sensational Sherry coming out? Not as Queen Sherry, but now all of a sudden she is with Ted DiBiase, but yet she is also still with Randy Savage as well. And I think in my own then 11-year-old brain, I probably would have thought of it as this. Clearly, Ted DiBiase and Randy Savage are pals. They developed a mutual respect in 1988 because of their wars. Ted understood why Savage turned on Hogan, and think of all the business dealings they've had since then. In 89, they clearly had owned a timeshare on Zeus, where they kind of passed him back and forth and used him, you know, to get at Hogan. They were allied on hassling Dusty Rhodes in 1990, Savage at the beginning of the year, and then DiBiase just buys Sapphire, all that stuff, to get her away from the American Dream, distracts Dusty during his match at SummerSlam against Savage. So those two guys, low-key, were certainly helping each other, not to mention in the 1990 Royal Rumble how they were kind of, you know, allying themselves with each other very early in the match. So yeah, mutual respect between those two guys, but never something that was put on screen other than Savage's coronation as the Macho King. Because I remember DiBiase was one of the front and center guys. That was one of my favorite coronations, because you had the genius reading the proclamation for his brother. DiBiase's there. The Warlord is there for some reason. So great. Now, Gorilla, on the other hand, doesn't trust Sherry because he's talking in the post-WrestleMania 7 world. Says, how can you trust her after what she did to the Macho Man? Well, let's think about it this way. I'm thinking about it from pre-WrestleMania 7, and DiBiase doesn't know that that's going to happen yet. Kayfabe hat on. But his program is with Roddy Piper, because you're not going to have him doing matches with Virgil, because you really want to stretch that out and extend Virgil's relevance to at least SummerSlam and a little bit beyond that. So he's going to be facing Roddy Piper on the house shows, which means we get a Piper inset promo, and God only knows what he's going to say.
Ted DiBiase, fine, ever-looking son of an unnamed ghost. Half the world has tried to beat me up, or in my fault you got no friends, but let me tell you something. Next time you see me, I'm going to need this, because I'll be real.
Kind of a rare blunder in the audio mixing, because they needed to turn down the crowd a little bit so you could hear Piper better. But if you missed it, he tosses the crutch at the end, the one that he had at WrestleMania. I guess it wasn't enough for him to actually throw the crutch and hit Danny Davis in the nuts at WrestleMania 7, which to me is the actual final payoff of the Danny Davis angle of 86 and 87, is him getting hit in the nuts by Piper at WrestleMania 7. But they had a match at the first house show that I ever went to in April of 91 at the Boston Garden, in which Piper lost to Ted DiBiase via referee stoppage due to the knee injury. A pretty creative finish that you didn't see very often on house shows. Back in the day, you would see blood stoppage, especially during the Bob Backlund reign, and even Bruno before that. But not a lot of injury stoppages, but it was a creative way to not have Ted, you know, taking yet another loss, as he seemed to do all the time. And Piper was not going to get pinned by him, so you were gonna just kind of do that. As for the actual match, I became so excited when DiBiase, off an Irish whip, hit the Ted DiBiase power slam, because I've seen so many other guys do it, and I've been giving it grades of 2 Teds out of 10, 4 Teds out of 10. I'm so excited about this, I'm giving 14 Teds out of 10. And this wasn't even all that great, it's just that I'm so overjoyed to actually see Ted DiBiase doing the Ted DiBiase power slam that I'm just going to overrate it, because I have a lot of, you know, I guess star rankings left over to give to that one. Million Dollar Dream finishes shortly thereafter. And now I'm waiting for the bit that I love with Sherry in the Million Dollar Man, when he would put the money in the poor guy's mouth, Armstrong, and then Sherry would walk by at the end, take it out, and stuff it in her cleavage. But unfortunately, they skipped that, because I don't think they have it quite established yet. It's their first time out together. And, you know, we'll get about 10 more months of it. So, a lot of that to come. So, I just wrote, oh well, maybe next time.
Not going to try. It's Hayward pulling it down. Getting around Zubat at midcourt. Launches the shot. Oh, it almost went in! Almost went in, and Duke is the king of the dance, 2010.
If that Gordon Hayward shot goes in for Butler and they beat Duke for the national title in 2010. That's the greatest shot in the history of basketball, bar none, and certainly the most consequential, because I can't think of anything like a Game 7 buzzer beater or anything like that where it would, you know, equal, because it's a winner-take-all game. It would have sent shockwaves through sports books all over Vegas. I love that sort of stuff. Did I say shockwaves? Because now we're back to Mooney in the event center without an actual event to plug. I love how they only mentioned that UK show the one time, and Mooney's like, haha, it's sold out. But we have Earthquake yet again. So this is a two Earthquake promo show. And he came out of his Hogan feud okay here early in 1991. I'd say that a lot of the guys that Hogan faced, if you think back to Orndorff, although he was hurt, Kamala had the thing with Hogan, but he pretty much cycled out after that. The one-man gang was a little bit lost until he became Akeem. And Piper did, because that was through the sheer force of his personality. So Piper and Earthquake, I think, are the two guys who had actual programs with Hogan who came out of it stronger at the end of the day. So another Earthquake promo where, you know, he's doing the huffing and puffing and, you know, kind of dancing back and forth.
You know, everybody out there, baby, you better get yourself some Earthquake insurance, because the Earthquake is the only natural disaster in the World Wrestling Federation today.
And at 6'7", 469 yeah. pounds, there's nobody in the World Wrestling Federation that can tell me what I can cannot do.
Not only is there nobody in the WWF who tell him what he can and can't do, but apparently that also applies to SWS in Japan, because, yes, this is the week of the infamous shoot match between Earthquake and Koji Katao, Fred Katao, in which Earthquake earned major props by basically anybody who gave a crap about the business of professional wrestling. But Jimmy Hart, I have to call bullshit on what he said. I wasn't even listening for his babies, because he's the only natural disaster in the World Wrestling Federation? Oh, I beg to differ, because we're going to hear from the other one, the Texas Tornado. And Kerry Von Erich is a little lost after losing the Intercontinental title back to Mr. Perfect. He also was a little lost when he won the Intercontinental title from Mr. Perfect. In fact, Kerry Von Erich was lost quite a bit of the time, but hey, this is a Texas Tornado promo from 1991, by God, and we're going to listen to whatever the hell it is he has to say. Is he going to read poetry? Who knows?
You know, a lot of people have said, Kerry, now that I've been watching you on the WWF, you become the best shape of any time of your life, that you're doing better than you've ever done. Well, I'll tell you, whenever you're around the finest competition in the world, you come up and you rise to the occasion, to the finest competition. Now, let me focus on one man, Mr. Perfect, who he proved was not so perfect because he got beat. So Mr. Not So Perfect. And now we also proved the million-dollar man, Ted DiBiase, cannot buy everything, because now he can't even buy Virgil.
Wait a minute. Can't even buy Virgil? What does that mean? It's only $20. You get an 8x10 of Virgil, and he'll autograph it for you and tell you about his $150,000 a year teaching job that he shows up for once a week. That's one of my favorite Virgil stories, because it makes him sound like Elizabeth Warren. Like, what is the deal with him? They can't even buy Virgil. Is he suggesting that Virgil should be bought and sold as some sort of commodity? I don't know what the hell's going on. Kerry's a little bit out of his mind. I'm shocked that Kerry Von Erich is saying things that I don't quite understand. They go back to Gorilla, the Anvil, and the Brain. They tell us what's coming up next week, but that is it for WWF Wrestling Challenge, March 31st, 1991. Elsewhere in the podcast world, outside the Pro Wrestling Only feed, on the Our Vantage Point podcast, really kind of just a review of a show this week in lieu of the normal show because of WrestleMania week. They're looking at a 1982 WWF show from October 30th, and I have to admit, I've never heard two people get so excited that the Magnificent Morocco is there. I mean, talk about really hating Pedro Morales that much that you're excited about Morocco coming back. But, you know, know, he was a good promo back in the day when he was motivated. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, we get a quick recap of the G1 Supercard from someone who was there. And I'm talking about Brian Malonis in the ring, Mike Crockett outside of the ring, even though he spent a lot of time in the concourse talking to me. And we're going to hear more on that next week. So they still got to catch up to what Brian Malonis running a show up in New Hampshire, Astromania, at the end of March. So they have an awful lot to cover. Now, I only have one last thing to cover, and that is another exciting edition of YouTube Comment Theater. As always, these are actual YouTube comments left by presumably actual people with avatars and everything. We'll start with Mike978508. Slick talks, inhales every sentence, LOL. Well, that might have been just kind of a breathing exercise thing that he was doing. I don't know. Dan Hodgson says, that dude almost messed up his arm on that DiBiase power slam. Again, I don't care. I'm still ranking it 14 Teds out of 10. Nemo Hose says, Sergeant Slaughter, sellout, traitor. But the thing that I love about that is traitor is spelled T-R-A-D-E-R. I always love when people on the internet spell stuff like that. Just really makes them look stupid. Kevin Lutz says, I think Sensational Sherry was the best manager in the WWF. I do think she was helped by the fact that she only had one person at a time to worry about so she could focus her entire energy on that act. But for those years, 89 through 91, and once she goes to Shawn Michaels, you don't really see as much of it, but with the Macho Man, she was just absolutely dynamite. And I love the bit with Ted with the money, and as I mentioned earlier. Giovanni Rivers says, watching back brings joy and sadness. This was addicting. Yeah, 91 WWF can be a little addicting. It's just exactly like heroin, except with less needle marks. Life is a Parade says, just count how many guys are now gone in the intro. Amazing. And yeah, I actually watched the Signature 2 Wrestling Challenge, and I became very despondent because it was like seven dudes in a row who were dead. Arathur82 says, Donald Trump cheering Hulk Hogan. You can't get much more American than that. And I'm going to bite my tongue on that one because I think you might be able to get more American than that. I don't know, a soldier coming home and meeting his family at the airport, something like that. I don't know. I'm just spitballing. That'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. For next week, I will be doing a Memphis show, in part because of the Walking in Memphis series makes me want to do that, but also somebody left a review, a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown on iTunes, Apple Music, whatever the hell they are calling it this week, and said, how about a little bit more Memphis and a little bit of Portland? So I have a Portland episode. That'll be done in due time. But for a Memphis show next week, I'm trying to decide between two of them. I don't know. Maybe you could help me with this. There's an episode from 1988 with a parking lot brawl between Jerry the King Lawler and Eddie Gilbert, but also a different kind of Memphis, Memphis Championship Wrestling, a developmental territory of the World Wrestling Federation in 2001 that, of all things, has a match between William Regal and Bryan Danielson, which automatically makes that video particularly interesting. So it's probably going to be one of those two. It's also some 84 Memphis that I've been kind of puttering around. Austin Idol, Rick Rude stuff going on in that one. So it'll be a definite Tennessee flavor too next week. Maybe I'll make myself some ribs this weekend, Memphis style, no sauce. So F you, JR. That's all I have to say about that. And then, as I said, please leave a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown and also the Pro Wrestling Only feed on iTunes/Apple Music. Thank you so much for listening, and do tune in next time for another episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Mustafa, what kind of name is that?